When I started my flight training, I eagerly found myself at the university bookstore purchasing the materials I needed to start flying. "Oh, hun, you forgot to pick up a plotter," the cashier told me as she turned around and grabbed one from her stash on the counter behind her. "Don't worry, I have one here for you," she said as she continued to scan the rest of my stuff. "Thanks. Do we really need all this stuff for flight training? How was I going to fit all of this in my flight bag?" I said out loud unintentionally, thinking about Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh, and if they had to carry around so much gear when they started to learn how to fly. "Don't worry, we have larger flight bags too," the cashier said with a grin. "I bet," I responded sarcastically. I walked out of the bookstore, barely able to carry all of the stuff, including the seat cushion that I had to purchase to ensure that I could reach the rudder pedals in the airplane. On the days where I had a flight training activity at my university, I had to carry an enormous load with my backpack, flight bag, seat cushion, and of course, my coffee. I longed for the day, which I thought was far into the future, where technology would reduce the load student pilots would have to carry for each flight. But then again, it seemed unlikely, since most airline pilots had to carry a flight bag that weighed up to 50 pounds. Can you imagine? Ugh. Fast forward to 2016, not that far into the future, I started to plan for the global flight. By then, the industry had embraced new technology like apps. Applications like ForeFlight and the Garmin Pilot app, where the sectional charts, approach plates, airport diagrams, NOTAMs, the airport facility directory, they were all available at your fingertips. Due to the weight limitations of the Bonanza that I modified to fly around the world, I had to be very careful about what items I carried on board. With this, Garmin generously donated a subscription to their app to help me get around the world. The Garmin Pilot app, also known as my co-pilot, allowed me to carry my once heavy and overloaded flight bag all in one device. In addition to it being convenient, the integration between the Garmin Pilot app and the Garmin G530 avionics was just mind-blowing. Uploading my flight plan from the app to my Garmin 530 took seconds, which manually can take up to 20 minutes based on the long flight legs around the world. My prep for each flight became seamless as all the most recent international approach plates and NOTAMs were accessible to me to study in my hotel room the night before. All of this technology made my life so much simpler and allowed me to fly safely. A new wave of innovation is about to sweep the industry with space, drones, airport design, eVTOLs, autonomous aircraft, and biofuels, just to name a few. I am so very excited. Even more, I cannot wait to see women be a part of this innovation. Let's dive deeper into this topic, shall we? Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Atlantic Aviation. Atlantic Aviation provides aircraft ground support in over 60 locations across the U.S. I'm proud to be partnered with a company that puts their people first and values diversity and inclusion. Their vision and mission is evident through the various resource programs they support. Experience the Atlantic Attitude today. Check out atlanticaviation.com to see all 60-plus locations and plan your next visit. Today's guest is Kirsten Bartok-Toe. Kirsten is the founder and managing partner at Air Finance, which specializes in structured finance, leasing, and the financing of aircraft with an emphasis on emerging markets. Prior to Air Finance, she was the vice president of strategy, structured finance, and corporate development at Hawker Beechcraft Corporation. Kirsten was a co-founder, board member, and CFO at ExoJet, where she was part of the original core executive team that built the private jet charter company and developed its innovative business jet outsourcing model. Prior to joining ExoJet, Kirsten spent over 12 years in private equity, venture capital, investment banking, and capital markets. Most recently, Kirsten was a partner at Alpine Investors, a San Francisco-based investment firm, where she focused on aerospace, business process outsourcing, education and training, as well as retail. Kirsten received a bachelor's from the University of Pennsylvania, where she was a Benjamin Franklin Scholar, and an MBA from Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Kirsten, welcome to the Aviate with Shasta podcast. So Kirsten, you are a part of three different sectors. You're part of aviation, tech, and finance.
Yes.
How did you find yourself in this unique position?
That's a great question. It happens kind of, it's fortuitous, but I started in finance and built up a career there. And I would say that if I were giving advice to young people, that half of life and half of your early career is figuring out what you like and what you don't like. And I had, funny enough, thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but I ended up being lucky enough to get a job at Goldman Sachs and realized, kind of having the experience of working in finance and with lawyers, that I definitely didn't want to be a lawyer. And I loved finance. So I feel very grateful that I had the opportunity to find something I like early on and figure that out. So the rest of it is just, again, a path one takes in life. And sometimes you don't know which path. If someone had told me 20 years ago that I was going to be in aircraft financing or aircraft investing, I would have said no way, or advanced air mobility. It just, and when I started in this sector, I will laugh and joke that I didn't know the difference between a piston and a turbine. And I remember having that question, being like, okay, guys, back to the numbers, focus on the numbers, because you're going bankrupt and that's a problem. So that story comes to is I'd started my career out of Goldman Sachs and then Stanford Business School, and really knew I wanted to be in investing and wanted to be in that sector. But I started in tech investing. And that was a fabulous time to be there and really taught me a great deal in Silicon Valley. And it's such an innovative place that I often think that you should put yourself in different environments and situations, put yourself out of your comfort zone, because you'll learn so much. And the West Coast has such an entirely different focus on the world than the East Coast, where the West Coast is all about risk and taking risks, and people are valued based upon their thoughts and what they're doing rather than where they have a job or what job's on their resume. And I love that about the place. So was doing technology investing at the time, venture capital, and it was right around just before the tech movement. I'm going to show my age for all of you that I was a venture capitalist back in 2000, 2001, and the tech world crashed, and everyone tried to recreate themselves. And to stay to some extent still focused on technology, but it wasn't the hype that you had in the internet boom that we were seeing earlier. So at that time, I was at a private equity firm or venture firm focused on smaller companies, growth emerging services. And I partnered with one of our investors who came in was an individual who had founded a company called Ariba. So again, in the tech world, but he'd become a pilot because he loved it. And we then together started looking at these companies called FBOs, which anyone in aerospace will know that that is a fixed base operation. So a private airport, Teterboro is always the biggest FBO, and they were doing roll-ups, still today are popular, but they were really early at that time. And we started looking at a few of those. And with that, we ended up coming up for one that wasn't a great fit for our investment fund, but they were looking for a transaction. And I joke that I'm not the most creative person in the world, but my creativity always comes out in term sheets, which shows what a dork I am. So is that I love to be creative. And we put together a really interesting transaction. It's kind of a distressed deal because they weren't making money. And on a negative side, about 6 months after we put together this deal and put about $2 million into this company that was still growing and emerging, they ended up tripping all of our covenants. And I think the management team, who was great guys, were exhausted. So we ended up getting handed this FBO, and they had a part 135 and a part 145 certificate. And the investor and I, my partner in this, were stuck with thinking, what do we do with it? And in the end, that became ExoJet. And I think that all goes back to the world of being in Silicon Valley and thinking innovatively about what your next steps are and how to create something. What are the innovators? Where are the opportunities out there? And not thinking linearly about being stuck with that. I eventually took those worlds, and you look today, and I always joke that my expertise is basically I'm the bridge between the finance world and aerospace. And what now it's become emerging technologies in aerospace in Silicon Valley. And that has become my expertise. And certainly as a woman, to have a very even narrow area of expertise that few people understand as well as you do is always a good way to create a moat around yourself, which is important. Just as a competitive company, you want a moat. In terms of the workplace, you also want a moat. What do you do better, and what do you do differently, and what do you know more about than anyone else? And that was always kind of my area of expertise. Like I said, I would never have admitted a thought to be here, but it evolved that way over time.
You know, during my research on like the future of aviation innovation and aviation and aerospace, I kept finding your name at conferences and on panels. And, you know, as a woman, I'm always looking for the woman that's, you know, in the room. And as soon as I read your background, I thought, wow, I would love to have her on our podcast so she can talk to us and more people can get to learn more about you and all that you're doing. So very excited. So in aviation, we're starting to see more innovation with space, drones, technology, and eVTOL, which stands for electric vertical takeoff and landing, for aircraft that uses electric power to hover, take off, or land vertically. What are you most excited about in terms of what you're seeing?
I'm excited about it all, and I'll tell you why. And again, showing my age, I remember being at the beginning of the internet and Netscape and Yahoo and everything that was occurring back in the late 90s. And to be able to look back now and see how that world has developed. And there were a lot of technologies and companies that were created too early, like that they weren't. I always joke at Cosmo.com or WebVan, companies that today, or as we know, delivery of goods and services via the internet and the iPhones are ubiquitous, but it took a while for the middleware, the infrastructure to build up. I am equally as excited about this next evolution in aerospace. You know, we've got two different points that are driving, one in space, which is entirely different than also driving the one in advanced air mobility. It will start easily with advanced air mobility. Just the change of electrification becoming possible and new technologies around hydrogen and fuel cells and how hydrogen can be delivered and green hydrogen to really make it clean. And what those technologies, especially the electrification side, can bring for distributed propulsion, which means different composition and architectures for aircraft. I mean, if you think about it, the aircraft has not essentially changed. We've got, you know, engines have slightly changed over the years, turbofans, like innovations, but the aircraft as designed hasn't. Well, electrification is allowing that power to be distributed and relied on in different ways, which will mean that the aircraft of the future will look vastly different than what it has for the last 80 years. That's crazy and incredible to think of that rapid pace of innovation that is coming to us. And then add to that the autonomy side, which is an additionally equally as exciting part, so that in the future, all of these vehicles will likely be on autopilot, whether it's remotely piloted or eventually in autonomy. But that is where our world is going. And those two technologies are leading to just transformations everywhere in terms of how ubiquitous aircraft will be, the size, how they're used, the sound barrier, you know, that we see it'll be more discreet and available to not be in imposition. So I think the future is for the side of air mobility, and then add to it the focus on climate and the need to kind of reduce the carbon producing elements that are involved. Yeah. I'm so excited for the next 20 years and wish I were younger to some extent. Oh. You know, in space, you're seeing a totally different one. And again, Elon Musk, who is at the head of both the electrification, autonomy, and also the privatization of space, deserves so much credit across so many industries. But what we're seeing there is, and this is a totally different driver, is who would have thought that a couple things, commercial space would be viable, could be done better, and how you approach manufacturing and the reusability of those assets. So you've now got the whole value scheme is upside down, and people are now thinking about it differently. And it's been attested, it's been proven to some extent. So that has caused an explosion. Never mind, now you've got small launch and small sat and GEO and LEO capabilities. And now an understanding of the war is no longer on the ground, but it will be in space in terms of data and how we gather that data, how we garner, how we protect ourselves, how we communicate. It is all now up in space, and that will be our future. So for me, we're at the beginning of two huge rapidly evolving technologies and ecosystems so that they will look vastly different in 20 years. So the prior 20 years have been relatively stable, and the next 20 years will look completely different. And it is so exciting.
It really is. You're absolutely spot on. All of this innovation and technologies hitting the aviation and aerospace industry right now, and it's a great time to be present and participate. And, you know, I was watching a couple of videos on autonomous flight, and there was one on X-Wing where they show, I think it was a King Air taking off. There was a safety pilot on board, but the whole entire aircraft from takeoff to landing was controlled by a pilot that was on the ground. And in this video, they're talking about implementing this in cargo operations, and it might be too soon for commercial operations. Where do you see aviation in 10 to 20 years, especially the commercial side of it, with all this technology that's going on?
Well, I think the interesting part is the technology will go faster than the regulators. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason it can't be in commercial. Yeah. It's just, one, it's regulations, and two, it's customer acceptance. So I do believe that there's a lot of focus on cargo, because cargo is such a cost issue, and that there's a thought process that the regulators will allow this remotely piloted in the first phase, and then later autonomy to take over. Coming from the pilot perspective, so I joke that this is all the same world we've been talking about for years, which is removing tasks from pilots, automating tasks. We call it pilot assist in the traditional world, and then they call it autonomy over here, but they're really the same thing. They're just removing tasks and automating them until you meet in the middle. So, you know, for a long time, we've had autopilot. We are now, in the past year, we've been moving to changes in having auto land only in the case of the non-capacity of the pilot. But that capability, you know, when you talk to the larger OEMs, has existed for a while, and they've just had trouble getting the regulators to allow them to go from a single pilot to from two pilots to single pilots, certainly in the larger aircraft. So our goal is, and I think this, I say our goal, it's the industry's goal, is to really demonstrate through trial and data that these technologies can work, and that they can be implemented safely, and and that how they can be used in commercial practice and have commercial needs and demands driving that. And I think that's what you're seeing with X-Wing is let's start, and they're using a caravan, so which is okay. very exciting. And they're yeah. looking to focus on the UPS and FedEx deliveries of remote packages and automating the caravans. And they'll start originally with remotely piloted one-to-one, where you'll have one controller outside and you'll have a person in the cockpit for the beginning. And then okay. eventually you'll have a pilot who can remotely pilot, just as you do for drones now and for Reapers or things like that, can pilot two or three. And they'll need some help on the ground, but not a lot. Yeah. And we should be able to disintermediate that process, which is a great thing given the pilot shortage.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the numbers put out by CAE or Airbus or Boeing, you know, we are it, and then add to it the VTOL, the propensity and the growth in that space, you know, that pilot shortage is going to be huge.
Yeah. Oh, we're seeing it so much right now with all these reports coming out. I kind of want to shift a little bit and talk about some business advice that you have. But before we get into that, you are the co-founder of ExoJet. How did you get into starting up a private jet charter company?
Again, luck and where you find yourself. I'm always a curious person, which shows as to kind of how I've dug into this area in the last 5 years. But I was giving the story earlier. I was at a kind of early stage private equity firm that was focused on services businesses. And one of our big investors who I'd gotten to know well was a private pilot. And mm-hmm. we started looking at FBOs. So with that, we found a company that wasn't a fit for the fund, actually, because it was losing money, which many FBOs do. And this was a 135 and a 145 company as well. And we invested in it. And unfortunately, they ended up tripping our covenants. So you kind of put covenants as an investor. And this was something I joke, I mentioned this earlier, I didn't know piston from a turbine. But I would get everyone to focus back on the numbers because I'm like, you're losing money. You won't be around in a year or two if you continue to do this. So how do we make this work? And they were great people. They were pilots who love what they're doing. Yeah. But they hadn't always, you know, thought about how to run a business so you're making money and you can reinvest in it. And that was the issue. So with that, we'd had experience in private aviation and knew that there were some limitations into the model now. You really, at that point, only had NetJets as an alternative. You could have your aircraft managed by a company like EJM or Solaris, or you could buy a card. But there weren't many options in between, and there was so much. The cost to a NetJets was extremely high with how NetJets runs. They really had a large core fleet, which meant that their overhead was high. So you wondered, and everyone wanted to fly. They had incentives, so everyone flew on the same times, and you got upgraded. So, and 35% of the routes they flew were deadheads. So all that went to the cost. We said, well, aren't there better ways to do this?
Right.
And so we ended up taking what was Woodland Aviation, a 135 provider in the Sacramento area, and kind of converting that to a company called ExoJet, which the goal was to kind of take a next generation fleet operator to really think about, okay, it doesn't make sense for everyone to have their own jet, because that means in the US, if you guys have done any research, you know that, and it's even less than it was today, but aircraft are used only 4% of the time. So that's an extremely expensive aircraft that sits AOG, so 96% of the time in a year. So if you could utilize that aircraft more, if you could fly more hours, somewhat even slightly closer to the 5,000 hours that commercial aviation flies, then you would be able to cut the cost and be more efficient. So what we did at ExoJet, the real thesis behind was kind of taking a Southwest JetBlue approach, had the same aircraft type. And at first we did just the Citation 10 and the Challenger 300, but then also get your deadhead down and fly more. And to do so, we put incentives. So we really were transparent with our business model, with our customers. We said, if you call us 24 or 48 hours in advance, we're going to have trouble servicing your needs. But we continue to give you on a lower per hourly rate if you tell us as far out as you know that you're going to fly. So if you know you're going to fly 2 weeks, let's get that aircraft booked. And then we can be more creative about alternatives and filling up, basically backfilling the flights we have. So let's say you have a customer that wants to go from San Francisco to Aspen, which is a lot of it, or they could go to Omaha, one of the two, and we know those dates, and you're going to be there for 4 days. Well, we can figure out a usage for those that aircraft on the 4 days in which they're down and not being used. So how do we, and if we know you're going to Omaha or Aspen, we can actively use those. We can also promote routes. So one of the things ExoJet did was they promoted routes where they always knew they could keep their uptime up. So they made the routes between LA and New York and San Francisco and New York less expensive, because if they could get greater uptime, less deadhead, and more utilization, then they could afford to give you a slightly lower hourly rate than what other people were charging. So again, it was really taking a holistic approach about how do we get this optimization up? How do we get our cost down and still provide an extremely high level of service?
Right.
It's evolved to something different today, but I still believe that type of innovative thinking, you know, we were kind of at the beginning of that in the business aviation sector.
Wow, that's fascinating. Incredible. You mentioned that you're a very curious person. And from the research that I did on you, I noticed that you're very open to trying new things, which I think is a little intimidating for people to try something different. How do you manage your successes and failures when you go into finding a new company or investing in a new company?
I think it's again, the mindset I spoke earlier about a little bit between the West Coast and East Coast is changing your mindset so that failure is okay, but that the saddest thing in the world would not be to try new things, to not be to move forward and experiment. So yes, not everything's going to work out and not every idea is a good one. But if we're not moving forward in the world, you're really wasting time to some extent.
Yeah.
And I think it's just that mindset, which is created. And it's also become what I think is fun. You know, coming up with new ideas, working on new things to do, and not just doing the same thing you were doing every year. So I've also, you look at the downside, you say, okay, if you try and fail, what's the doubt? What's the worst case scenario? And I think everyone looks at it that way as well, but you say, I'll go ahead and get another job. That'll be okay. I'll figure that out. I'll start something, you know, new. So I've looked at it from that perspective. And, I encourage people to be entrepreneurial early because it's certainly easier to be entrepreneurial before you have kids and need a little more of a stable life and income. So the earlier you can get that muscle flexing, the better.
Yeah, great advice. So I am the founder of a nonprofit, Dream Soar, and I also have an LLC called Women Soar Group. And the learning curve for starting both organizations has been like drinking from a fire hose. There is so much content online and on social media for business startups. What is your advice as a venture capitalist on how to get started? And also, kind of a follow-up question, are there any resources that you would recommend specifically for women?
Great question. I'll try and think of specific for women. Again, kind of in a change of the world, I think about, so 20 years ago or 30 years ago when I started out, you know, you had to go to business school to learn how to start up. You know, we went to Stanford to learn how to start up a company. What is the process? What is a venture capitalist? How do you do it? How do you create a business plan? The amazing thing today is you can learn everything on YouTube. Like every lecture is out there, every business explanation. I mean, if I want to learn how to blanch, you know, broccoli, it's out there. It's incredible. And when you think about that, it's so exciting. You know, my husband and I do, we both are kind of dorks in this way, but we just love going online and learning about classes that we would have taken before, or how do the dynamics, the aerodynamics work in a laminar flow. You can learn all of this online. You can understand, you get up to speed about how hydrogen works in propulsion. And that is just so special and unique. So for me, it's to be, I think the most important part is tenacious. Like figure out what you want to learn and then it is all available to you and you don't have to go, it's sad part for Stanford or Harvard or any of the business schools today, but most of it you can learn online. I think the other piece of advice I would say is go do it. There's no better learning than doing it. You may not do it perfectly. It'll probably take you four times as long the first time you do it, but go do it. And certainly earlier in your life, you have more time to spend in it. The last part is I think there are great innovation labs and what we call incubators today, which, you know, were just starting 20, 25 years ago. But I was on the phone with the guys who are starting Sustainable Aero Lab in Germany, and that they're global things. And even better now in COVID, everything's online, but it's connecting with entrepreneurs and mentors and people who've done it before who are willing to help you do it going forward. There are so many, again, just your own learning in your own world you can do on YouTube and online, but then connecting via those opportunities. I'd say the last thing is we sometimes forget to ask. If I had a failure in my life, I wasn't as good or as aggressive, and I say that in a nice way, about mentors. Mm-hmm. I was always worried about bothering them. Oh, if I call them up, I'll bother them. And I think as I've watched other people and their success, that maintaining and nurturing relationships with mentors were so important that people, you know, most people feel appreciative of people who help them out in their career, and they're happy to pay it forward. And you know, even in my perspective, and I think most people share this, I love talking with young people who are doing new things because I learn, I get new ideas from them. Right. So as a young person, I would encourage you not to be bashful, to try and connect, find a way to, you know, connect with someone in your field. And there'll be times when, like, sometimes now I'm at a really busy point in my career where I have to say no. But then there are other times in your life where you've got more time and you've got more bandwidth to do it. So don't be deterred if some people, you know, can't do it right now. But I think people do have an interest, and work with those people. They want to be involved with innovative ideas, and they may not have, you know, the ability to do some of the heavy lifting that you can do now. So
yeah,
just go get it. That's the best advice I have.
That's really sound advice. Just quickly on what you shared as far as mentors go, when I started the nonprofit, planning a global flight around the world in a single engine bonanza,
know,
I just didn't. Yeah, thank you. I just couldn't learn it all, nor did I want to. So through our board of directors, and most of them were my mentors, helped the organization acquire an aircraft. We actually leased it, and I had no idea about the leasing world, and also about fundraising. And, you know, I kind of went into it thinking, gosh, I'm such a burden to these really busy professional people. But throughout time, I realized that they enjoyed it just as much as, you know, I did. So never underestimate mentorship, because it is a two-way street. And usually if it's a good mentorship relationship, both parties are getting as much out of it as anybody. So with that, what is your biggest learning lesson from your past mentorship relationships?
And I think you pointed it was exactly that. It's as I've gotten older and done more mentoring,
yeah,
I think it's a recognition of how much I get from those conversations and how enlightening that is. And when I was younger, I wouldn't have thought that those people I esteemed, those people I looked up to and respected, who I thought knew everything, would that I would have anything to share with them. And that was wrong. So I absolutely agree with you on that one.
Oh, that's great. So going back to the business side, aside from profitability and growth, what do you look for when you're investing in a company?
There's so many, right?
Yeah.
And the interesting part is a lot of private, and there, I should say, a lot of private equity investors or venture investors I know are not, let's say, disciplined, and they don't have, and I say, when I say disciplined, it's not, it's more that they don't have a list of qualities in which they invest in, but it is about pattern recognition.
Okay.
The most important thing I would say is that there's two parts. It's the management team and an idea. And you probably heard a lot of venture capitalists say, if I have a good management team, they'll find a good idea, but you have to have the right management team that iterates through it. You also recognize that the idea that wins in the end may not be the idea you started with. So I'm okay with that as an investor. Having been both an entrepreneur and investor, I know it from both sides, that you're going to come up with an idea. You've got to have conviction around that thesis. You've got to be compelling to investors. you've got to be sophisticated in how you present things. And I'll just give an example. You know, when we started pitching ideas 25 years ago, you didn't have to have an amazing PowerPoint. I think today, given the online opportunities to work with designers, you really have to have a sophisticated PowerPoint to break out the noise. You know, you've also got to have a high energy CEO who knows the detail, or her, who knows the details about her sector, can answer discrete and detailed questions. It's always a key to me when a CEO doesn't know a detailed question about their business. And speak with confidence. That's another part that, again, these things that are intangibles, which make up what is a great management team. Because whatever you're investing, yes, you're investing in the sector. And yes, they have to have a good idea. But you really are investing in people and how they present. And, you know, if I've seen more and more in the world is that you can have two people with, let's say, equally good ideas, or maybe not equally good ideas. Maybe one has a better idea and one has a worse idea. But the person who presents better, the person who has more energy, who answers things, who garners confidence, is the person who's going to gain, who's going to raise the money to move forward. And I think, unfortunately, that unfairness is lost on a lot of entrepreneurs, that they may not know that. I also can't say enough about, I have immense respect for entrepreneurs who are early in their career that I respected greatly and I thought had a lot of capabilities, but that they actually decided at a later date to bring in someone more experienced to lead their team. And that's an entrepreneur you'll, one, invest behind again because they made a mature decision. And two, that you just, I have enormous respect for people who say, you know what? Maybe I'm 32 and I'm not quite ready, or 28 and I'm not quite ready. And my company would do better if I brought this person in right now. I'll be the number two, and this person. And then you're setting yourself ready for the next one. And we have a word that I learned early in my career when I was at Goldman, and they always called it long-term greedy, which is think about the decision today versus the long-term. And maybe you're not the right CEO today, but you will be the right CEO for next time. Or maybe this isn't, tell someone, and how Goldman used to use it, tell someone this is a bad deal and they shouldn't be doing it. And because long-term, you'll end up being their close partner because you told them the truth and you were candid with them. So I say that about someone, you know, young people tend to be in a rush. And if you can think about your career over an arc and a long-term and have the confidence that you'll get there, that's important. And I'll add one little last thing. I joke, especially on the West Coast, people talk about being on the beach, and it came from consulting where you say, okay, I'm either between consulting roles or, you know, in the West Coast between startup roles. And everyone in the startup world knows that you need a break. If you just left one super intense startup, you need, let's say, 6 months to a year off to really get excited again, get your energy back up. It also allows you the time to make a really smart decision about what your next opportunity is, because your decision will be better. I also, and this is unfair to categorize the East Coast or West Coast, but people on the East Coast think it's really odd to be unemployed for a period of time, to be on the beach. And people on the West Coast think it's odd for you to go from job to job. They're like, well, you can't make really good decisions and you're not, you don't get the time to rejuvenate. So I encourage people to take more time to be on the beach, take more time between jobs, have confidence, and especially that you'll get a job, that it will all work out. Because the negative I would say is that I didn't take those times to be on the beach as well before because I was always worried about things. But if you can rest and be in the moment and know that you'll be okay, then you will make better decisions and you'll be better, you'll be more prepared for the next phase that you're going on. So again, the long-term perspective.
Yeah, you know, I love that piece of advice that you just shared, because after I completed the global flight around the world, it was 145 days flying from country to country, half a year, basically. And when I came back, the first question that everyone wanted to know, or that they would ask, is what's next? And for me, I just thought, I really need to go on a beach somewhere and just turn everything off. Yeah. And I did that. And it is scary because when you leave your career or after completing a very big project, you have all this energy and all these lessons learned. And to take a break, you're just kind of worried, you know, what will happen. But taking that time help me mature and just process everything that had just happened and course correct for the future. So it is a bit intimidating, but if you do it, it just nourishes your soul and makes you feel that much ready for the next adventure in life. So that's great advice.
And I think to your point, you also make a better, your vision is not clouded. You have right. time to kind of take in all the information and you really get a much clearer view of what is the right next step.
Absolutely. Another question that I wanted to ask you is that a lot of women are now becoming founders of companies, more specifically of nonprofits. Usually, the traditional way to raise funding is through donations or sponsorships. From what you've seen, how else can nonprofits generate funding that you would recommend?
For nonprofits or both? For both.
For both, if you have advice.
Yep. And I'm going to expand it to political candidates as well.
Okay.
Because I think that is one of the things holding women back generally is access to capital. And that's whether you're a political candidate, whether you're a nonprofit executive, executive director, or whether you're a for-profit startup founder. And it's nurturing those relationships to capital early and understanding how those dynamics work. I think the other thing to do, and this is why Silicon Valley works well, so I'm going to use this as an example, and this really stinks, but it is one of the things. If you associate with people in circles where you can talk to them at the sports game that your child is playing with or at a dinner party or something about a deal you're looking in, instead of calling them up and saying, hey, do you want to invest in this? Do you want to invest in my startup? Do you want to invest in my non-for-profit? Do you want to invest in my candidacy? If you can do that in a social setting, it is so much easier to raise money and it's so much less aggressive. So okay. that is why you've got this ecosystem, whether it's 128 ecosystem, New York City, Silicon Valley, other hubs, where though that's how the world works well. So placing yourself in one of those environments certainly helps with access to capital. And okay. I just have a huge amount of empathy for people who aren't in environments like that or networks where you can cross both the social side with the, whether it's philanthropic, political, or business side, because they all do mesh together. So with that, I think last year, we have to not be afraid to ask, and we need to learn and be better about, you know, finding that line between not being overly aggressive and being viewed as transactional, which is why I brought up the social side, right. but also not being afraid to be aggressive and ask for money and to tout your idea as well. So again, that's a nuanced world, which is why at business school, everyone tells you, you know, it's not always about your IQ that leads your success in life. It's about often your EQ, which is why, you know, it's that balance you've got to achieve.
When it comes to finances, what is your advice for women who traditionally have been excluded from financial planning in relationships? There are a lot of women right now taking more ownership of their finances, of their investments. What is your maybe top advice for them as they take more ownership?
My top advice is start trading stocks early on. If that means, and with when I grew up in the world, I think it was like $70 every trade or $80 every trade. And then it went down to $13 and now it's zero. And, you know, sometimes I hate the fact that, you know, order for payment is an issue, but I trade things that I'm interested in. So buy some stocks, spend $100, spend $200, get yourself knowledgeable, understand, take those lessons, figure out what you like to invest in and start early because then you learn. And it's freeing. I would take some financial literacy. I would read some books. I would do some of that because if you have that control over your life long term, your trajectory will be just completely different. And So I think that's it. You know, everyone talks about how important financial literacy is early on. We should be teaching it in high schools. And I absolutely agree with that. Especially, it's almost more important if you're a woman. because guys will go to a party and they'll talk about stocks. You know, I lament, I would much rather talk about stocks than decorating or trips I'm taking. But unfortunately at a lot of parties I go to, and it's not all, but the groups will divide and the guys will talk business and the women will talk about other things. And,
No, I totally agree with you on that end. And I just started investing in stocks, and it's such a just thrilling feeling to know about, you know, the different markets and keep up with the news. And, you know, it just, and the other thing too is my dad worked his whole life. My mom had six daughters. And because my father was always in charge of the finances, we were never taught anything about financial responsibility. So now that I have a son, I'm trying to learn as much as I can. And when he's old enough, I think for one of his birthdays, my husband and I were going to give him a stock that he can play with and invest in. But what is your advice? We talked about women, but for the next generation, in terms of planning for financial health in their youth?
That's a great question. And hopefully that you'll do the same and give a stock, whether it's a boy or a girl, because I absolutely believe in that. And the schools have a lot of, you know, my 10-year-olds last summer in COVID took a financial literacy class. I have a boy, girl, 10-year-olds. And they enjoyed it. So now we can talk a little more. They didn't love it. But yeah, I agree with you on all that. For next generation, I would again encourage one about saving.
Okay.
And two, about investing in yourself, whether that's it putting money away or buying a house or, you know, so that, and I think the third part is also thinking long term and understanding what being risk prone means versus being conservative. So helping our children be more active in taking control of their life and their career to find a path in which they enjoy. You know, you mentioned, like, I wish I worked out more. then there'd be other things I like to do. But the funny part is I really love what I do. Like, I partly learned so much about these emerging technologies because that's what I would do in my free time. I would study because I wanted to understand what was happening. So if you could have a job in life that doesn't feel like a job that you would do in your free time, that's a big deal. It just doesn't feel as draining, and instead you get energy from it.
Oh gosh, I love that advice. I really do. It's so important, and you only really have one life, you know, to live. So why not do something every day that you love and find a way to get paid for it? Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. And be creative. Look at what you've done with your career. You know, you've been innovative, you've been thoughtful, you've coped with new ideas, and you've paved your own road. And if you can do that, it's sometimes more risky and less financially rewarding in the beginning, but longer term, it pays off.
I hope so. Right. And since we're on the subject of the next generation, for those who are interested in aviation and aerospace, but haven't quite found a field of study, what would you recommend as far as a major for these interested young generation on a, sorry, let me rephrase this. For those who are interested in aviation and aerospace, but haven't found a field of study, do you recommend a specific sector that has an exciting or promising future?
In aerospace?
And aviation, yes.
And aviation. I mean, the good news is there's so many.
Right.
And our world is rapidly changing.
Right,
You know, so I would get involved in any capacity. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a firm believer in trying things out.
Okay.
Because you just don't know what you like and what you don't like until you try that job.
Right.
You know, one of the things I realized is I'm not good in isolation. I'm actually not great at doing research. I'm a little bit more peripatetic. I like a dynamic day where I do 50 different things during the day. But A lot of people don't like that. That's too much chaos for many people. Right. Or they don't thrive in, you know, as we've learned, not everyone can thrive working from home all day and keep themselves motivated. Right. So I would encourage people to try different things out. And again, back to what we discussed earlier, you can learn so much online. You will get a job if you go into a job having studied all the YouTube videos on it, and you will impress them. And they'll be like, oh my goodness, you need to be hired. This is great. And then when you're in your job, you know, again, be excited about it, which is why we talked about liking what you do, and learn everything about it so that you can expand your role and you can talk more about it. You can do more within a firm, because those are the type of people that are going to be promoted quickly.
Right.
Those people who spend their extra time learning and really and show that they're adding value.
Yeah, very good. And I have one final question that I ask every guest on the podcast, and that is, what has been the best advice you've received as a woman in aviation?
That's a good one. Let me, I think I would say two.
And
the first one, which is advice that goes everywhere. You know, you, as a woman, the bar is a bit higher. You always have to be a little bit more prepared. You always have to be a little bit more knowledgeable. I think it's important to approach things from a work perspective. Mm-hmm. In that way, you always need, and especially now that we're online, you always need to look professional and mature and buttoned up. And I think it's how you display yourself matters a great deal in how you will be perceived. Just the same when I was talking about fundraising for a startup.
Right.
If you portray yourself as an energetic, knowledgeable CEO who understands every detail of their business, you will raise money. And it's the same thing in any job or role. If you portray yourself as highly competent, knowledgeable, together, and mature, you will get the next role. You will be hired. So that I want to underline as important. I think the other thing is you really have to go. We used to talk about being colorblind, but you have to go into environments being, you know, textuality blind and blind. And in that way, I mean, you know, I sadly enough don't always notice when I'm in a room with, let's say, all guys and just me. And, you know, and often is that because we all are passionate about the same thing. We all love aerospace and aviation. So we have that mutual love of what we're doing and that camaraderie. And that's another thing that I've really appreciated having been in other businesses to aerospace, is that people love this industry and they have that mutual interest, and that is bonding. It also tends to create that, you know, there aren't that many jerks in the industry for that reason.
Yeah.
Because it's a small industry, people tend to know each other. So your reputation matters. So I would say that try to be blind about who's in the room and just act as you normally would in any situation, and don't change your behavior based upon who you're in, and don't be uncomfortable. The last thing, because this will go for women, I will say that the funny part is I think that we women both are lucky and hurt in the fact that we use more tools to keep ourselves looking young than our male colleagues do. So I remember at one point, probably 10 years ago, that there were two peers of mine, and we found out that we all had birthdays within a month of each other. But I had always thought these guys were older because they were great. And they, you know, just looked a little bit older or something about that. And it was a good lesson for me in terms of, because I colored my hair and I wasn't graying earlier, all of that, that I looked a bit younger. So that stuff matters too, again. And that's why I put out, in any position, whether you're 22, 26, or 36 or 46, you know, portray yourself in a mature way. You always want to be energetic. You always want to be excited about what you're doing and knowledgeable. But you also want to be mature and thoughtful and a good person to work with. And that matters across all aspects.
Oh my goodness. So much great advice just now. Thank you for that, for sharing that. Well, Kirsten, thank you so much for your time. I think this conversation has been very fun, energetic, lots of great information to unpack and to take with us in our careers. Thank you for the important work that you're doing and for being such a great role model for women in aviation. So thank you again for your time. We appreciate it.
Shasta, thank you for having me today. Thank you for doing this podcast, as well as for all the exciting things you're doing for profit and nonprofit around and leading the world and being a real go-getter and risk taker. So we need more of that.
Thank you. Thanks.